Annie Leonard is a well-known American advocate for sustainability and a critic of excessive consumerism. She's best known for her animated film, The Story of Stuff, which has had almost 14 million views on YouTube since it was posted in 2007. Many more people have watched it on DVD. Australians, actually, are among the most enthusiastic viewers. We rank fourth out of 200 countries. Since then, Annie's made other films, including The Story of Carbon Trading, Bottled Water, and Chemicals in Cosmetics. And as you'll hear a bit later, the Occupy Wall Street movement has caught her interest recently. She has a knack for being able to explain complex ideas in easy-to-understand terms, but not surprisingly, with so much at stake, she has her critics as well as her fans. Annie Leonard's been visiting Australia to speak at various events and share ideas, and I caught up with her late last week.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, your basic message is a pretty simple one. How do you sum it up?
We're using too much stuff. We're using too toxic stuff. We're not sharing it well. And the worst is we're not even having fun. That's my basic message, that we could do so much better.
It's like an extension of that idea of buying clothes that you don't like in order to impress people you don't like.
Right, people that you don't even know increasingly.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. I'm really concerned about how much we're using in terms of its toll on the planet, how much we're using in terms of the pollution and the toxic chemicals, but also how our relationship with stuff has gotten out of balance. So we're looking to stuff to fill non-stuff needs. We're looking to consumerism to express our sense of self-worth, our identity, our belonging to a group. And it's just simply not an effective strategy, nor is it ecologically possible.
No, it's very effective, though, in terms of making money for the people who are selling us the stuff. What got you started on this?
You know, I got started on it when I went to university in New York City, and I was just mesmerized by the huge piles of garbage all over the street. Just every day I would walk to class and see these shoulder-high piles of garbage. And so I started wondering, what is in all those bags? And that's where I picked up my habit, which embarrasses my travel companions, of looking in garbage wherever I go. It is absolutely fascinating window on a community is to look at the garbage. It's like reading a community's secret diary. And when I looked in this garbage, what I saw was that there was tons of really good stuff in it, useful paper, books, clothes, shoes, appliances. I realized how much we were wasting. I wanted to figure it out, so I literally did spend 10 years traveling around the world looking at the factories where our stuff is made and the dumps where our stuff is dumped. And I saw that all this stuff in our life has a hidden environmental and social and health and even emotional cost that is not being discussed. So I wanted to experiment with different ways of talking about this that would be engaging and inviting so that we can together figure out how to do things better.
Well, the film, The Story of Stuff's, had a huge impact, as I mentioned. And it must have been one of the first truly viral campaigns. But how do you use the awareness without scaring people into thinking, this problem's just too hard, it's too big?
Right, well, the film has been enormously helpful at sparking discussion. It's been being shown in tens of thousands of schools, in churches, even in corporate sustainability trainings. It's being shown all over the world to get people talking about this stuff. And the scary issue is complicated because the truth is, it's scary. I mean, if you actually look at the data of the impacts of climate change, at the scarcity of water and oil, at the growing inequity around the world, I mean, it really is scary. But I don't want to dwell in that place because, you know, fear and guilt, and these are not very resourceful places to be. So let's get the data on the table, let's look at it, let's have a rational assessment of where we are, but then let's figure out what we can do about it. And the good thing is there are so many things we can do about it. You know, we have like a solution smorgasbord buffet in front of us. There are an infinite number of things that we could do better, and that is what, for me, counters the fear, is how possible it is to do things better.
Essentially, you're asking us to think before we buy. But is there any evidence that we are? I mean, especially when, I don't know, for things like small appliances, it can be easier and cheaper to replace it rather than actually find someone whose business is fixing it.
Right, so I do think we should think before we buy, but our leverage there is limited because, as you said, the choices made before the stuff even gets to the shelf, that's where the real power is. So really what I'm saying is that the company should think before they make so that the onus is not on us to find the least toxic, you know, longest-lasting product, that all products should be less toxic and longer-lasting. So I'm asking manufacturers of consumer products, of electronics, of appliances, of cars, of furniture, make them less toxic, make them more durable, make it easier for us to buy responsibly, because right now those choices just aren't available to us at the store.
But, I mean, haven't a lot of these businesses made a lot of money by piling high and selling cheap? I mean, what you're asking them to do will inevitably cost them more. It'll cost us more. We won't buy as much if we're throwing away stuff or if stuff is wearing out, is lasting longer. We won't buy as much. Isn't it in the interests of the companies to do exactly what they're doing now?
Well, it's not in the interests of the companies to exploit the planet so much that it's no longer able to sustain life. You know, that model of, you know, the take, make, waste as quickly as possible, that model might have worked when our planet was less full, when we had more resources and less demand. But we're now at the point that we are consuming more resources than the planet produces each year. According to the Global Footprint Network, we're now consuming 1.5 planets full of resources each year. So you simply cannot consume 1.5 times what the planet provides each year indefinitely, even if you were unimaginative enough to think that was the best option. It's simply physically not possible. So any company that is concerned about sticking around for the long run has got to figure out a different way to run their business that is not based on trashing the limited resources we have. It's just simply not a possibility anymore to continue with that model.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Annie Leonard, who's director of the Story of Stuff project. You might have seen her work actually on YouTube, and she's been in Australia giving talks and sharing ideas. One of the things I think about that, though, Annie, is that a lot of the stuff is made by companies that have to report their earnings half yearly or even quarterly, and you know, they're run by people who have to stay in that job, have to keep growing the business and doing as well as they can. And you know, this longer term thing, that's going to take away from profits now.
Well, a couple of things on that. One is that we have to figure out a different sort of accountability mechanism to corporations so that they are not beholden just to shareholders in the next quarter. There's a very interesting movement developing called for-benefit corporations, which says that the corporation's obligation is not just to shareholders, but also to the communities where their factories are based, also to the factories, also to the broader society, so that you can look at a broader range of indicators about how well the corporation is doing. So if it's turning a big profit, but it's depleting a non-renewable resource or poisoning its workers or host community, then that's simply not acceptable anymore. So there needs to be a reevaluation of what a proper business is. Businesses need to figure out a different way to thrive economically, provide jobs, provide services that don't take such a toll on the planet. And there's some incredible innovations in that category. One of the things that I think is really exciting is businesses that are starting to look at providing services rather than stuff. So, for example, if you have a large Xerox machine in your office, often the company doesn't own the Xerox machine. You lease the use of that Xerox machine. What if we did that with iPods? What if we did that with furniture and cars and everything, where we're actually paying to use the toaster, the television, whatever it is? If that was the case, rather than buying and replacing it, there would be a built-in incentive to make these things as durable and long-lasting as possible. So there's a lot of different approaches that businesses are taking to provide the service and things people need without feeding into this manic consumer frenzy.
One of the facts that you like to highlight, and I find this staggering, I mean, are you sure about it, is that only 1% of the stuff we buy is still in use 6 months after we buy it.
Actually, that's a slight misunderstanding of the fact. It's 1% of total materials flow in the system is still in product or use. And that was calculated by Paul Hawken. People ask me about it so much, I will tell you it's on page 81 of the book Natural Capitalism. But what that's talking about, that includes the upstream waste. So if you have a laptop computer, that includes the tons of waste that were made at the mining sites and the factories where it was made. So it includes the total material flow. So what that means is of all the stuff that we mine, harvest, process, transport, package, of all the stuff that runs through our economy, only 1% is still in product or use 6 months after the date of purchase. And that is not a sustainable way to run an economy. And that's why we're using 1.5 planets worth of resources each year and growing.
I mentioned you've also got your critics, and at home in the United States, some have called you un-American for your stance. Is that a tough thing to cop?
You know, it's a baffling thing when people call me un-American, because I feel like the best way to honor my country is to want it to be the best it can be. And if you look at a variety of indices, from education, literacy, health, environmental protection, obesity, a huge variety of indicators, the United States is plummeting. You know, on the Happy Planet Index, which is a global measure of how efficient countries are at converting natural resources into human well-being, we rank 114th out of 114. Now, I think the un-American person is the one who's blindfolded to this data and is like, oh yeah, America's number one, when we're not, we're actually 114th. The true patriot, the true country lover is one who says we can do better and let's move up. Australia, by the way, is not doing that much better. You're 102nd out of 143 on the Happy Planet Index, so you can do a little better too.
Well, I'll ask you in a moment about any reasons for optimism, but I want to ask you firstly about the story of cap and trade, because you've made these several films. One of them's Cap and Trade. It's about carbon trading. That is a big political issue in this country. We've got the legislation for our carbon tax having gone through our lower house, and that carbon tax is supposed to be temporary. Then we move to emissions trading. But you have concerns about that whole approach.
I have huge concerns, and not just me, there's a growing movement of climate justice activists, they're called, that have concerns about emissions trading on a bunch of reasons. One is that it just simply doesn't work. There are enormous opportunities for cheating. You know, companies who say, I was going to triple my output, but I'm only going to double it, and therefore I've reduced carbon, so you have to pay me, which I can then sell that right to pollute to someone else, so you actually end up with a net increase in carbon. So it's not effective in reducing carbon, which really has got to be our number one goal right now as we figure out how to run our economy. Plus, it really disproportionately benefits the big polluters and disproportionately harms the most impacted communities. So both from an environmental perspective and an equity perspective, it is just a flawed approach, and there are so many better ways to do it. So let's just get it off the table and find a real solution instead of get caught up in this market-based false solution.
Well, I'm interested in that because last week I know you spoke at a conference of the Society of Sustainability and Environmental Engineers, and you seem pretty hopeful about what they're doing.
Oh, I loved that group. They were just fantastic. These engineers, they are really science-based, fact-based people. They are grounded in reality, not ideology. And what they say from what they see is that we are facing a dire environmental problem and that massive amounts of technology exist to do things better. So they are frustrated about the slowness of the uptake of the better technologies. They say that right now, with existing technologies, we could reduce carbon by 85% by 2050. So let's not mess around with this silly little market-based mechanism that benefits all these polluters. Let's start implementing these carbon reduction technologies that exist right now, putting these conscientious engineers to work, building a sustainable, safe, and healthy future. I mean, that is really the only sensible option out there.
I mentioned that you've been taken with this Occupy Wall Street movement, and of course, the GFC has really hit your country very hard. What are you going to have to say about what I think is going to be called the story of broke?
So the story of broke is really a response to this phony austerity measure that is just crippling the United States and many other parts of the world. And how it manifests is that when community members and activists and sustainability-oriented engineers say, we want to do things better, we want safer technologies, cleaner environment, good schools, the response that we keep getting from government is, there's no money for that. Renewable energy, nice idea, but it's too expensive. National health care for everybody, nice idea, but we can't afford that. And they say, there's no money. The truth is we are not broke. There is plenty of money, but it is being concentrated in the 1% super wealthy elite, and much of our public monies are actually going to prop up what we call the dinosaur economy. So in the United States, where we're shutting down schools and libraries and environmental protection programs because we say we're broke, we're giving $10 billion a year of subsidies to oil and gas companies. So what we're saying is we're not broke. There's plenty of money. It's our money. Let's get it back from propping up the dinosaur economy and put it to use building a safe, clean economy for the future.
Your message seems to have a big audience as well as in the United States. I mentioned here as well all those YouTube hits. What do you put that down to in Australia?
You know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to come to Australia, to find out why people are so resonant with the film. I think it's because people in Australia are smart. People are connected to nature. You have really high level of innovation and forward-thinking people here, so they know that they can do things better. So that's why I accepted this invitation to come from the Sustainability Engineers, is I wanted to meet these people.
All right. Well, Annie, it's been great having you on the show today.
Thank you so much.
That is Annie Leonard, who's director of the Story of Stuff project, and you'll find more details of what she's been up to on our website, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Coming up next on ABC Radio National's Life Matters, the man who's just been awarded the 2011 Justice Medal.